Hi, this is Doug Henwood. A message for you podcast and web listeners. I do this show because KPFA broadcasts it. Despite all the technological advances of recent years, terrestrial radio still provides legitimacy and reach, and I wouldn't keep doing this show without KPFA. Besides, KPFA is a great institution that badly needs your support. They're fundraising for the next few weeks, and this show was one of my fundraising efforts. I only broadcast about two-thirds of this interview with Mark Blythe to make room for the begging. But in this version, you can hear the full interview. If you can, please support KPFA and mention Behind the News if you do. You can get Mark Blythe's book, Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, for a pledge of $100. If that's too much or not to your taste, any other amount is welcome. Please visit kpfa.org and pledge if you'd like to keep these coming. And now on to the show. Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. My guest today is Mark Blythe, professor of international political economy at Brown University. His new book, Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, just out from Oxford University Press, is an extremely timely intervention given the prevalence of the doctrine across Europe and the U.S. Where does it come from? Whose interest does it serve? First, a few quick words in the April employment report, which was released on Friday morning. Employers added 165,000 jobs in April, 176,000 in the private sector, and gains for the previous 2 months were revised upwards by 114,000. The revision, and I should say these sorts of revisions are absolutely routine based on later arriving data, the revision to February made that month the best since 2005. But, and this is an important but, it's a measure of how far down expectations have been reset that these seem like strong numbers. They're well below long-term historical averages. We're still millions of jobs short of recovering what was lost in the recession. And the mix of jobs that are being created is also less than inspiring. Lots of retail and food service. That's bad for living standards, but it's also not a firm foundation for healthy long-term prosperity. We're doing better than the poor Europeans, but that's about all you can say. We have a serious employment and income problem in this country, but no one in a position of importance construes this as a serious issue. No, to the fancy people, the deficit is the problem, and we need to tighten our belts. Well, to be fair, the austerity party, which had been cruising along with little political challenge, especially in Europe, is suddenly on the defensive. There's the issue of the famous paper by Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff, which I discussed last week. That paper supposedly proved that countries with public debt-to-GDP ratios greater than 90% grow much more slowly than those with lighter debt burdens. I said supposedly because though their findings were widely accepted by economists, pundits, and policymakers, they turned out to be completely unjustified by their own evidence. This was discovered only a little more than a week ago by three University of Massachusetts economists, Thomas Herndon, Michael Ash, and Robert Polin. Though Herndon, a graduate student, did much of the work. I don't mean to disparage Ash and Polin, however. They're both fine economists with good politics. Once Reinhart and Rogoff's errors were corrected, including some basic Excel mistakes along with some conceptual oddities and data omissions, their findings largely disappear. But the political scene is changing, too. It's becoming more obvious that European austerity isn't working. The countries on the periphery, the so-called pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, have cut spending and raised taxes mercilessly, but their economies keep sinking. Britain, thanks to its reactionary Tory government, has imposed vicious austerity on itself. The economy is a wreck and shows no signs of recovery. On the European mainland, political figures are starting to question the whole strategy, which is being driven by Germany and its junior partners like the Netherlands. Italy's new prime minister, Enrico Letta, who took office just the other day, has been saying that his country has had enough austerity. Well, it's not quite clear what he means by that in practice. Here in the U.S., we've heard lots of calls for austerity, though thanks to gridlock, the austerians haven't gotten all they've wanted, and our social spending was never that generous in the first place. The sequester, which now seems like the new baseline scenario, is a mild dose of austerity, and state and local governments have been cutting spending for years. But still, we've yet to experience anything on the scale of Europe. Promoters of austerity offer a couple of arguments to support their view. One is the "we just can't afford it" argument. Another is the almost religious belief in the need to atone for past excesses through self-denial. Yet another is that debt is actually a burden on prosperity, so if we cut, private actors, meaning mainly rich people and executives, will turn optimistic and invest and spend and hire. The idea that an economy as rich as ours can't afford a civilized welfare state and a beautiful public infrastructure is ludicrous. We have no problem affording vast weapons systems and luxury goods. The idea that we've binged is ludicrous when most people below the 90th or 95th percentile have done nothing of the sort. And the final argument, that austerity will lead to a boom, has been empirically proven nonsense by the European experience recently, and before that by the Latin American debt crisis of the 1980s and 1990s. Yet, austerity arguments persist. Maybe they're losing a bit of appeal, but they still have a lot of power behind them. Why? What's the source of their appeal, and to whom? Here's Mark Blythe with some answers. Welcome, Mark Blythe. First of all, tell us about your background. This talk of austerity actually is rather personal for you.
It is. Hagen, where would I start? I grew up in Dundee in the late 60s, early 70s, and into the 80s. I was the original child of Thatcher. So I'm well aware of the effects of budgetary consolidations, having seen them firsthand. And there's an asymmetry in all of this that gets buried in this idea that we're all going to tighten our belts because we're all wearing the same pants, which is we're not all wearing the same pants, and we seldom are. And when we talk about budgetary consolidation, you're talking about basically taking resources away from the least advantaged members of society in the name of asset protection for those who already have the most. And that's really what this story is. So when the G20 come out with a communique that says growth-friendly fiscal consolidation, that rings an alarm bell that I've heard before that essentially says somebody's in a creditor-debtor standoff. The creditors want their money back. The debtors can't pay, so we're going to take it by any means necessary.
And you make it clear that a lot of this austerity really is just making sure there's enough money to give the banks, right?
Yeah, behind it all, particularly in the European story, this is a banking crisis, and we kind of missed this in the United States because, in a sense, we dealt with it. Now, one of the interesting things for me in the bank during the book is discovering how much of the banking crisis that happened here resonates very strongly with Europe, but also because I started off as one of those folks that said, oh, well, you have to bail them, systemic risk, blah, 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 all the rest of it. And by the end of it, I became almost Tea Party-ish in terms of, no, let them fail. Because it's an extortion racket, and to continue an extortion racket is outrageous. But putting that to one side, the way that we dealt with it was we basically took the central bank and hosed down the banks, forced deleveraging and recapitalization, took the toxic assets off them, put them in the balance sheet of the Fed, and then you basically allow them to delever and recover. The economy is now in a positive growth cycle, even if the employment performance is terrible. That means credit's getting extended again. Businesses are rebuilding. We've got 2.8% for the year most likely coming out of this. And then as the economy recovers, you sell the assets back. So QE properly thought of as an asset swap. The Europeans can't do this. They've got a central bank which is more like a currency board. They're still fighting an inflation that died in 1924 as its only mandate. So being intellectually and institutionally unable to deal with it, they can't even really tell the European publics what's going on, which is you've got a banking sector which is essentially three times the size and twice as levered as the United States. It's interlinked, it's cross-border, even though everybody's effectively borrowing in a foreign currency. You've got national bank resolution mechanisms, but none of them will work because the states involved don't have their own printing presses. So you have a kind of gold standard in a democracy problem where you cannot inflate, you cannot devalue, you can't actually allow a default because it will blow up the core banks, hence why you've got to keep the Greeks in at all costs and squeeze them as hard as possible because it's a contagion trigger. And the only thing you're left with then is deflate, otherwise known as austerity, which I like to call squeeze, add liquidity, and pray. So what starts with the banks goes on with the banks. We managed to basically get through the cycle. The Europeans haven't even started to address the cycle.
Yeah, in contrast to the too big to fail, which is very familiar here, in Europe you have too big to bail, you say.
Exactly. When you add it together, the asset footprints of these banks relative to the GDPs of their sovereigns is astonishing. The French one is my favorite example. The top three French banks come out to about, depending on how you count it, 230 to 260% of GDP. The top four British banks, but at least they have their own currency, are nearly 460% of GDP. It's absolutely astonishing. So think about it. If you're running a bank that's running 40 to 1 leverage, which is not uncommon in the European Union, you don't actually control your own currency. You can't rely on a bailout from your own sovereign as a consequence of this. And what you end up with is a situation whereby these banks are just contingent liabilities, chock full of assets. A 3% turn against their assets means that they're illiquid, if not insolvent. And you can't remove the assets from the banking book. You've got a big problem.
Okay, let's go back and look at some of the histories of these two, the crises on each side of the Atlantic. First, in the U.S., well, actually this is true of both sides of the Atlantic, this is mainly a private sector crisis that has gotten retold as a public sector crisis. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. I call this the greatest bait and switch in human history. Because essentially what happened was, if you go back to the 1920s, when the banking sector went bang in the United States in the 1920s, the incomes of the financial sector fell. And when they fell, that actually created the conditions after World War II for a more equal set of growth dynamics going across the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and that's the birth of the middle class in the United States and so on and so forth. This time, when we did the bailouts, what we did is effectively guaranteed the assets and the incomes of people who were already causing an income skew, which had gotten so bad that the United States is the same Gini coefficient as China. So we did income insurance for the top, and the way that we're going to pay for this is basically by cutting services at the bottom. It is a gigantic bait and switch.
Okay, now the United States, I think a lot of the listeners are probably familiar with the story of the housing bubble and the weird securities that helped finance it. But you write about the prevailing bad theory of risk management in the financial sector, in which the regulators also adopted. What do you mean by that?
Well, in this case, I was very much influenced by the work of a good friend, Nassim Taleb. And he's often seen as somebody who's much more on the libertarian side of things. But on this stuff, I think he's absolutely right. Essentially, the idea is that there's unpriceable risk out there. The common name for it is black swans. And if you're basically calibrating models, which are very, very precise but also very fragile, to data sets which are 6 or 7 years long and then projecting them 20 years ahead to price your mortgages, it's almost shocking that you're not totally wrong. So we get caught into this collective delusion with value at risk models and other types of models that rather than actually just measuring everybody else's data exposures in terms of the real exposures, what we're actually doing is missing what the real exposures are because we're kind of like drunks under the lamppost looking for where the data is. So the fixation on quantitative modeling, value risk analysis, Basel weights, risk weight adjusted, etc., leads on the one hand to gaming and arbitrage and on the other hand to a mispricing of risk. So a very simple example of this is that if you basically have an asset bubble and a particular class of assets that are booming, let's call it housing, and people start to buy lots and lots of houses, well, as the price of those assets go up, there's a certain way in which when they're embedded into the portfolio, they're risk-adjusted downwards because they're seen as safe because they're in demand. So what's actually happening is your numbers are telling you you're safer when in actual fact you're buying a highly levered asset, so your real leverage ratios have been hidden. So there's lots of perverse dynamics in the system that goes on because of the way that we do risk management in general. Now, this doesn't mean that like all models are bunk and all that sort of stuff. I don't want to go that far because ultimately we all use models implicitly or explicitly. And if the option, the alternative to this is basically just, you know, go with your gut, then how can I trust the gut anymore? But it's just that these models have built-in fragilities and blind spots to them, and we were dangerously unaware of those going into the crisis. When you add to that lots and lots of leverage and lots of complexity from derivative structures, you kind of build an accident waiting to happen.
Now, this all sounds perfectly clear in retrospect, but is it possible to know this in real time? Could people have foreseen this? Should they have known better?
That is always the difficult question. Is this Monday morning quarterbacking? And, you know, Andrew Lowe from MIT's Finance Lab has a piece called something like Reading 21 Books on the Financial Crisis. And at the end of it, he kind of throws his hands up in the air and says, well, there's too many causes, too many effects. The whole thing's overdetermined. How could you possibly know? And, you know, that is the reality of the world. We're kind of hardwired to look for linear solutions in what is a very, very complex nonlinear world. But there's certain things that you should be aware of. I mean, the first one is if you calibrate your models for housing to the worst ever collapse that's happened, and that's Texas in the 1980s where it goes down 40%, you've basically written off the possibility of a 50% drop in asset values at zero. That's a hell of a big assumption. If you're basically chucking lots of risky assets together and everybody's buying the same assets, you're building correlation into it at the same time you're actually trying to avoid the correlation of the assets. So in a sense, there were bits of the puzzle that we knew, but when you added it all up, what you needed to know was something that was an extremely unlikely event happening, which is basically all the liquidity in the world dries up as everybody tries to be liquid at once. And the warning for that was given in the back end of the general theory where Keynes says, there's nothing as noxious as the fetish of liquidity. where everyone tries to assume that which is private and discovers, in fact, that it's a very public affair. For somebody to be liquid, somebody else has to be illiquid. So if everybody tries to be liquid at once, you evaporate all the liquidity in the room, and all these highly leveraged structures, which seem perfectly stable at one point, suddenly become very unstable.
I'm speaking with Mark Blyth, author of Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, just out from Oxford University Press.
We can understand how the banks would not be wanting to ask too many questions. They were making lots of money, and it looked like they would be continuing to make a lot of money for a long time. But regulators are supposed to know better or act as if they know better. Are they just so captured by the interest that they're meant to regulate that they're not likely to step on any toes? Or are they sort of fall prey to the same exuberance and delusion that private interests do?
Well, there's been some good work on this. I mean, Barth and Levine have a book, Guardians of Finance, that really takes the regulators to task on that side. And there's also Simon Johnson's book on the same thing, on sort of political capture. I'm actually more interested and more convinced by the notion of intellectual capture. I mean, nothing succeeds like success. So we have this story for 25 years that markets are good, states are bad, liberalization is the way to go, and things seem to work. And we went through the 87 crash and nothing really happened that much. We went through the dot-com crash and nothing really seemed to much happen that much. So there's all these stories out there about derivatives allow risk to be held by the people who are best holding, you know, able to hold it. And transparency is really all you need to know. And obviously these people have skin in the game and so on and so forth. So there's this wonderful correlative effect, whereby the story we tell correlates with the reality. And the longer it correlates, the more we confuse correlation and causation, and we believe that this is true. So if I was a regulator in 2004, I don't think I would be thinking hypercritical thoughts about the banking sector, because for the past 20 years, year on year, it had produced really, really solid positive returns, and no one had blown up yet, at least in the core. Now, the signal, of course, is, well, what about everywhere else? Around the world, there have been 118 banking crises between 1970s, actually in the 1980s, 1990s alone. If you go back even to the developed world, I think the figure is from 1977 until the financial crisis in 2007, there are 17 developed world banking crises. But then we were always willing to blame someone else. Then it was crony capitalism. Then it was the tequila crisis, the Mexicans getting on over the head. Deep, developed, mature markets, we don't do that sort of stuff. So there's a kind of an implicit ethnocentrism that combines with this confusion of correlation and causation with stories we like about markets being good and states being bad to intellectually capture regulators as much as any political capture.
And we also like to tell tales to ourselves about the great moderation, which had supposedly taken over. We'd mastered the business cycle.
Yeah, that was a perfect example of this. And again, this is the correlation and causation one. Take the British example. You've got Gordon Brown banging on about prudence with a purpose. And Gordon comes in, and what does he do? He starts to pay back the national debt, and he drops British national debt to its lowest point, since the 1860s. And he gets all these plaudits from it, and the economy takes off like a rocket, and the City of London is making all these profits. So, of course, the story is reduce your deficits, and you'll be rewarded by the markets. Well, there were lots of countries around the world that didn't do that, and they also rocketed. We were caught in the midst of a global credit bubble. But it's very hard to step outside of that bubble and see it for what it was, rather than basically tell your locally rational story as to how what you were doing somehow is the thing that's causing the boom. You don't have to be a venal credit claimer to make those kind of errors. So you end up with Gordon telling his story of prudence with a purpose, Ben tells his story of the great moderation, and everything seems to work fine until it doesn't, and then that's the big surprise.
And when the crisis first broke out in the U.S., some of the Europeans were kind of snooty about it, that this was an Anglo-Saxon crisis, and see, we told you so, you laissez-faire people do everything wrong, be more like us. And then they broke into crisis themselves. What was at the core of the European crisis?
The core of the European crisis is very similar to the American one. I mean, I alluded to it earlier, but to get to the heart of the matter, essentially their banking sector is even more interlinked and even larger and even more leveraged than the American was in 2006. So you have a bunch of global banks which have been borrowing in a foreign currency, going to American wholesale markets, setting up SIVs, chucking the money from the wholesale markets to buy mortgages, making profits off that, repatriating that back to the home country. They were up to all sorts of stuff. 70% of the SIVs involved in the mortgage crisis came from European banks. So these guys were knee-deep in it. So you had German politicians who have a uniquely blind way of looking at their own financial sector, as if what happens is somebody drops off money at the savings bank and then it shows up in the Mittelstand for BMW 5 days later, when in fact it's flying around global and local bond circuits and into in and out of derivatives markets. Deutsche Bank became one of the biggest players in global derivatives, which is a far cry from the sort of very solid sort of standard banking model that the politicians seem to assume they have themselves. So basically what happens was Greece tells the truth for the first time in 50 years about its deficit figures. The markets freak out. As they freak out, they immediately price in the possibility they're going to have to dump these assets. They then look at the debt-to-GDP ratios in a continent that has higher debt-to-GDP ratios than the Americans and says, hell, if I have to dump this, what am I going to do? I'm going to have to sell on something else to cover the loss of the portfolio. So if I have to price Greece now at X and then have to look at the next most likely thing to get sold, which is Portugal. So Portugal goes from X to X plus 4. And then I have to sell in Greece and Portugal, I'm going to have to find something else, and then I'll sell in Ireland. So suddenly you get this yield spike right across these areas. Now, Ireland went into the crisis with, if I remember correctly, 26 or 13% debt-to-GDP ratio. I get it mixed up with Spain. They were both very low. One was half of the other. So 13 and 26%. Now Spain's in the 80s, and Ireland's over 100. And what happened in the interim period? You've basically bailed out your financial sector and dumped it on the public balance sheet. Again, that great bait and switch. All of this turbocharged by the fact that you're doing it in a currency union, which means the countries concerned cannot bail out their national banks. And also, because of what happened over the 10 years of bond buying in the euro markets, these banks have become individually too big to fail and collectively too big to bail. And the ECB can't deal with the problem. And then the Germans aren't big enough to liquidate the problem even if they wanted to. So they really are stuck in a rock and a hard place.
You made this point, but I want to underscore this. Going into this crisis in Europe, only Greece had really outlandish debt figures, right? Everyone else is in pretty good shape.
Yeah, and it wasn't even that outlandish. I mean, basically what happened was they had a government that came in and trying to shame the opposition that had just gone out, said, look at these people, they're all total liars. They said the deficit's 7%, it's actually 12, in fact it's closer to 13. And they didn't expect what would happen is the global bond markets would collectively freak out on the news of something that's the same size as Alabama, declaring that it's got a bigger than expected deficit. But what that was doing was pricing in contagion risk. And once you price in contagion risk, Greece just becomes a trigger for Portugal, which becomes one for Ireland, and then very suddenly you're at Spain. And the exposures go from Spain to the French banks, and the French banks have 30% of GDP in periphery debt stuck on their books going nowhere, and they gave their printing press to the Germans. They've got a problem, and they don't know how to fix it.
But it was certainly not a tale of the public sector gone wild with profligacy.
No, absolutely not. Even in the Greek case, if you decompose the figures, you find that half of it went on investment. I mean, where do they think the Athens subway came from? Here, another one for this one, the great story of these profligate southerners. Go to stats.oecd.org and go to labour markets and look up hours worked, and then look at who actually does a hard shift in Europe. It's the southerners. The Greeks work 2,000 hours a year. The Germans work 1,200, and yet they're the ones who are supposed to be lazy. So there's a huge amount of political construction of this being some kind of public sector profligacy crisis. And even in the Greek case, which is a tiny, tiny component of Eurozone GDP, it's happened. It's certainly true that they were profligate. But my God, there's been worse examples of that in human history that hasn't caused this much damage. And it's the interlinked nature of these markets through the euro which has caused the problem. Everyone's pricing in a default risk on a currency none of them control.
Okay, let's turn to the intellectual history of austerity. And this takes us back into the days of Locke and Hume, right? So trace the evolution of this idea for us.
Sure. What I call it in the book is, well, actually I started calling it this in talks, and this isn't in the book, and it's a nicer way of encapsulating it, that liberalism has a neuralgia with debt, and whenever the nerve pain of debt flares up, they reach for the aspirin of austerity. Now, why do they do this? They do this for the following reasons. If you go back to Locke, even before Hume and Smith, the foundations of English capitalism and the Glorious Revolution, you basically have a bunch of people that know that in order to get the world they want, they need to take over the state. But the state's the antithesis to this thing that they love called the market. But the reality is markets and states are always closely imbricated, and in fact, if you really want to make markets, it's nice to be in control of the state. So from the Lockean Revolution onwards, this revolution in property and all the rest of it, you have a problem because you now have private property and private wealth, which is a very, very high income skew associated with it if left to its own devices. So you need a state to come in and police those distributions to make it possible. So a quote from Adam Smith, For every rich man, there must be 500 poor, and he is always attended by jealousy. Were it for not for the firm hand of the civil magistrate, he could never guard his property. Another one from Adam Smith, my favorite quote at the end of Book 2 of The Wealth of Nations. Civil government, insofar as it is instituted for the defense of the rich against the poor, or for those who have property against those who have none. Now, you might think that was Marx, but it's Smith. Adam Smith and Scottish Enlightenment, Hume a lot as well, come along and say, okay, how are we going to fund this thing? Because we can't live without it. We can't live with it, but we don't want to pay for it. Hume comes along and says, there's a great wheeze, it's called debt. It seems like it's a free option, but there's a problem. Because the idea is that the state gives me a debt instrument where I get my money back after a certain period of time, and it pays me interest for lending the money. So this is perfect, right? You make the distributions of income and wealth possible that I like, and you pay me for doing it. This is fabulous. The only problem is, in order to make this work, you'd need to offer me a rate of interest higher than that I would get in the market. If I got that rate of interest, I wouldn't invest in the market, so the underlying productive assets in the economy, as Hume puts it, all the gold and silver that would have productive uses, would get diverted into debt securities. Eventually, debt markets would become the only thing that's going on, and eventually the underlying growth would collapse. This is the origins of the crowding out hypothesis. Smith adds to this that ideally you should have progressive taxation because those with the most skin in the game should pay the most for asset protection. But then, in classic Republican style, he turns around and says, ah, but that would be unfair because the rich would pay the most taxes. So therefore we need a consumption tax, a tax on any consumption above luxuries, just like the Republicans are arguing today. And he says, but there's a problem because that will never raise enough money, so I guess we're stuck with debt. And the problem with debt is, ultimately, it's too easy for states to issue it. We like it too much. It perverts the parsimony of the entrepreneur, as he calls it, of the investor, of the saver, and ultimately, at least, the ruination of the nation. Now, this is a great story, and all the stories that we hear today are linked up in this of Ricardian equivalence, before Ricardo even called it. There's crowding out. There's, you know, all these sort of effects. But the problem was this. When Hume and Smith were writing in the 1770s, British debt was around 30%, 20% of GDP. It rocketed up at the end of the Napoleonic Wars over 200% of GDP. So they correctly predicted this massive increase in debt. And then what happened was Britain went on to rule the world for a century and a quarter. So there's a bit of a problem with the debt leads to collapse and enfeeblement story because it led to world domination. Perversely, in part because British securities markets became deep, highly liquid, and therefore led to a great deal of capital accumulation. It's funny how these non-linear effects happen. But that's where the origins of the neuralgia lie, and we're basically just telling versions of the same story today.
We're listening to Mark Blyth, Professor of International Political Economy at Brown. His book, Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, is just out from Oxford University Press. Back after a musical break. Some of John Cale's Face to the Sky from his newish album released last fall. Let's pick up with Mark Blyth discussing the long intellectual pedigree of austerity. His book, Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, is just out from Oxford University Press.
Yeah, it's remarkable reading those passages, how, aside from the antique language of several centuries ago, we're still hearing the same things from pundits and editorialists today.
Oh, it's exactly the same arguments. There's a brilliant book by Al Hirschman, the economist, from 1994, I'm sure you know it, called The Rhetoric of Reaction, Perversity, Feudality, and Jeopardy. And he basically says that all arguments against reform could fall into one of those three buckets. And essentially, that is what's going on today, because you have these arguments about debt, which basically say the first one is, well, you know, you can try and spend your way out of it, but you'll end up with more. And of course, the reality is the opposite. The more you try and cut, the more you end up with debt, because you basically slash the GDP and the constant stock of debt gets bigger. But you have a perversity story. You have a futility story, which is, oh, well, you can try and do this, but it will never work, so don't try. And then the last one is you have the jeopardy one, which is, well, if you get to 90%, you just fall off a cliff and then you die. So these things fall into these three buckets and have been said without modification for 300 years. We should probably begin to question them a little bit.
You mentioned the 90% figure, which makes me wonder what you make of the discrediting of the Reinhardt and Rogoff paper.
It's interesting in the sense that everyone's already written it off as discriminating. So, you know, it's just written off, you know, the discrediting in that sense. And it's quite interesting. I mean, I've been following this closely, and for what it's worth, here's my take on it, right? I've never really put that much stock in it because it's a statistical finding. And I teach this kind of history of economics class, and one of the slides that I give to my students is the Phillips curve for Britain, a statistical finding. And Milton Friedman made great hay out of this with the vertical Phillips curve in the 1970s. There's no long trade-off against unemployment, inflation, and all that sort of stuff. And the numbers in that period, the statistical finding really seemed to support that. I then give them the next slide, which is the British Phillips curve from 1992 to 2007. It's completely horizontal. You can have whatever level of unemployment you want at a constant rate of inflation. And yet we still tell the statistical story of Milton as if it's true. So I look at Reinhardt and Rogoff, and this is a statistical finding. It's just a question of time until it gets debunked, either by time itself or somebody goes and checks the numbers. And in this case, they went and checked the numbers. It doesn't really have that purchase of being part of the intellectual lineage in the way that the expansionary fiscal consolidation work does or whatever, which really sort of ties into the old Smithian and Humean stories. So you find out there's an Excel coding error, fine. You find out there's something strange going on with the weights, fine. At the end of the day, their defense is you still have lower growth when you get to a higher rate of debt. Aaron Dubé came along and recalculated the numbers and basically shows the relationship is quadratic. In fact, the worst place to be is in the middle, and when you have really high debt, there actually tends to be a slightly better growth profile. So at this point, I don't know what to make of that, other than the fact that it's a statistical finding, and on their own, devoid of any basic causal story, I have no reason to believe that a priori.
A lot of this, though, is not really what we would think of as economics, but it turns into a morality play, doesn't it?
Yeah, but the entire thing's a morality play, and capitalism is essentially a moral story. That those who basically save will be rewarded and those who spend won't. I mean, go back and read The Wealth of Nations. Parsimony, not industry, is the cause of greatness and wealth. We're all hardwired to barter and truck, but more importantly, we're hardwired to save. So those who save are good and those who spend are bad. And of course, the classic story in this, where it all fell apart in the 1930s, was that you have two sides to the equation. We can't all save at once. You need income from which to save. If we all try and save at the one time, you simply shrink the economy. Somehow that was forgotten, and yet it comes back as expansionary fiscal consolidation. Yet the evidence is in. Every country that since 2009 has tried to cut its way to solvency now has more debt rather than less. Lay it out in a line. Britain's deficit this year is going to be about 7.5%. The United States is going to be under 5%, and Southern Europe's in double figures. We don't need any more evidence to know this is self-defeating, and yet we keep doing it. Why? Because we've cast it as a morality play. They spent too much, and now they need to pay the price, and it's not a morality play.
And a lot of that spending on the periphery of Europe was financed by Germans during the bubble, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Their saving is the cause of their sinning. It's manifestly impossible to have overspending unless somebody on the other side of the equation is overlending. Yet we never blame the banks for overlending. Here's something. I wonder if you can remember this one, Doug. Do you remember in 2003 to 2006, Citibank had a slogan? It was the world's first billion-dollar advertising campaign. Do you remember Citi's slogan from those years?
I do not.
Live richly.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Not be rich, not save up, not do some smart investments. Live richly. It was a money pump. It was a credit pump financed from the private sector. And if you have the largest economy in Europe as a chronic saver because it's an export-led economy, so basically it can never do Keynesian policy even if it wanted to because it doesn't make sense. Because if you simply pump up wages and prices, you end up just killing your exports, the same as Canada as a commodity exporter. So you basically save more than you should. You don't consume enough. Your banks take these surplus savings and then buy periphery debt with it. They know this because they know it's a good deal because they know the euro is coming in. So they're buying as the yields converge. So they do it by pumping up the volume and doing it with leverage, either this kind of volume plus convergence trade. And you end up stuffed with periphery debt. Your balance sheet becomes so big, you become a systemic risk to your regulator. So you're too big to fail, which, as we know from the United States, is a highly successful business model. So all of this begins and ends with the lenders. The creditors are the tail on the dog.
Okay, back to our historical story of the evolution of this idea of austerity. How did it make its way from English origins into the United States?
The U.S. story is fascinating because you basically have a split in 19th century economics. On the one hand, you've got people like David Ricardo. And David Ricardo's line is basically, markets are fine so long as they're not intervened with by government. My favorite line from Ricardo is, the condition of the poor is always wretched and is likely to be so. But his answer is, so long as prices are flexible, everything will be really cheap, so it doesn't really matter. And down that track follow the Austrian economists. And the Austrian economists, the original ones from von Barwick onwards through to Mises and Hayek, who end up having a great influence and indeed in some cases residence in the United States, and also Joseph Schumpeter, who becomes the business cycle theorist par excellence at Harvard in the 1920s, they have this story about the long-run capital structure of the economy and how ultimately you get credit distortions from banking, which is not incorrect, by the way. And then this is why you get these booms and therefore you get the bust. And what you need to do, to quote Mises, is above all, you must curtail consumption. So you get this austerity story coming out, not just a morality play, I like to call it emetic economics. When you've binged on credit, you have to throw up, and that's the price that you pay for resetting the clock. And the problem with the story is if everybody tries that at once, you don't reset the clock. The only way to explain the Great Depression was for after 10 years of it not resetting was either that, to quote Andrew Mellon, the competent people that were meant to come along and pick things up singularly didn't show up, or alternatively, trade unions were pricing everyone out of a job, which in an era of mass unemployment and low wages seemed very, very unlikely, and also why GDP was shrinking across the world. And the answer was because you were doing simultaneous contractions of the five biggest economies in the world. So, of course, global GDP was shrinking. And, of course, debt stocks were getting higher. The Brits had 170% of debt to GDP in 1931. By 1933, it was 190. And all they were doing was cutting. The best example of this was Germany, where you had Brüning coming in 1930. The short-term American capital had been pumping up the German economy, left because of a seniority swap in the Young Plan and higher interest rates in the U.S. To balance the budget, they just cut. The Social Democrats abandoned any attempt to argue against austerity, just as they're doing today. And the vote for a minor party called the Nazis went from below double figures to 18% to 43% in 3 years. So there's a lot of dynamics in here which are extremely familiar and extremely scary. But the American side of the story comes from the Ricardian side to the Austrians, and the Austrians getting into business cycle theory, and that kind of blows up in the 1920s and 30s in their inability to explain why the Great Depression, A, happens, and B, lasts long.
It's funny how Americans talk a different story from what their economic history would suggest. I mean, we're very profligate in the 19th century, defaulted frequently, stole intellectual property, and now, of course, everyone's supposed to pay debts and observe intellectual property with great respect.
Absolutely. You were also the country with the highest tariffs in the world throughout the 19th century while you were stealing other people's technology. So there's all those little facets going on with this as well. Yeah, I mean, the profligacy is always the fault of the sinner, and the creditor always needs to be paid back. Well, the thing is, if you actually look at this through history, the standard story the creditor tells is that there's either inflation, which is bad for creditors, deflation, which is bad for creditors and debtors. They sometimes tell the story that inflation is bad for debtors, but it's nonsense. You have a big mortgage and you've got a fixed rate mortgage, eat away half the value. That was what a lot of people made out in the 1970s. So if you don't do inflation, you don't need devaluation, you don't want to do default, all you're left with is austerity. Well, it's not really true. There's also financial repression. You basically make those captive banks, which are over-levered and on the brink, de facto wards of the state. You take your war bonds, or in this case your 10-year bills, and you reissue them with longer maturities. You pay a lower yield and you run a positive inflation. You eat away the debt. And that's what we did after World War II, and for Britain and America, it was remarkably successful. And what it did was basically turn the place from a place for a regime that benefited creditors to one that benefited debtors. But the only way you can do this is if you basically punish finance. Well, given that they got all their assets bailed in 2008 and 2009, maybe that's just redressing the balance. I don't know. Maybe that's a bit too radical.
That's okay. Now, Germany. How do we explain the German love of austerity without resorting to creaky old notions of national character?
Well, you know, it is interesting that the word for guilt and the word for debt are the same. But, you know, let's put the cultural to one side. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. If you go back to the 19th century, basically Germany has a project of national unification. Bismarck's the lead guy. And they're pretty successful on this. They take back Alsace-Lorraine from the French and consolidate the state and do all this sort of stuff in 1871. And then their economic policy is heavily influenced by the example of the British. So they have this big stock market and all that, and it blows up spectacularly in 1873. At that point in time, Bismarck gets together with the Prussian elites, who've got the agrarian side of the country and the industrial elites, and says, what we're going to do is we're going to build a series of banks, and we're going to take the forced savings from the agrarian sector. We're going to sell the wheat to the Brits. We're going to take the profits from that. We're going to channel that into the industrial sector. You guys are going to basically reverse engineer products. You're going to turn out how to make better steel, better stuff, all the rest of it. And we're going to have basically state-led industrialization to play catch-up with the Brits. If that sounds a lot like Japan, that's because that's where Japan got most of their institutions from when they had the wake-up call in the 1870s around the same time when the black ship showed up in Tokyo Harbor. So you have these models of economic development which are very, very strongly state-influenced, to say the least, and are based upon exports. Now, the problem with that is for somebody to be exporting, somebody else has to be importing. So from the German point of view, it's been perfectly natural for them, and it's worked despite the dismemberment of the country, the failure to win two wars. They've got these industrial combines, Siemens, BASF, these companies. They've been around since the 1870s, and they've survived all this stuff. BMW and Mercedes make world-class products. They make great stuff. They also, because of the undervalued exchange rate that the euro gave them and then the Deutschmark before that because of the Cold War, make a lot of cheap, crappy stuff that makes a lot of money as well. But, you know, it's nice to be barbelled. Now, in that economy, as I mentioned earlier, it makes no sense to be a Keynesian because if you do demand stimulus, all you're going to do is increase wages and prices and hurt your exports. So you will fight that tooth and nail because it doesn't make any sense. This is why Merkel today is saying, well, if it's Germany on its own, we'd need to raise interest rates. And what people forget about the German success story the past few years, they haven't given their industrial workers a real wage increase in 10 years. How long can you keep that going? Well, America's done it for 25 to 30 years now with the bottom 40% of the income distribution, but that's because we had easy credit to basically smooth it over. They didn't even do that. So you have this big disjuncture now whereby you have a booming export sector, which is contingent upon growth in Asia, a declining exportability in Europe because of austerity, and an increasing income skew because the money's not being redistributed in the way that it used to be. So for the Germans, looking at, you know, austerity politics is the natural thing to do because it works for them. But again, it's a fallacy of composition. We can't all be them. By definition, for Germany to exist, lots of other countries have to not be Germany because we can't all run a surplus. We can't all save at once. And for some reason, that's the bit that they seem very reluctant to admit, in part because if they did, they then have to admit that what's behind all this is a banking crisis and that ultimately the German economy isn't big enough to bail out the whole European system that they've built. So they temporize. They go for austerity, they squeeze, they add liquidity, and they pray the problem goes away.
I'm speaking with Mark Blythe, author of Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, just out from Oxford University Press.
Some people might be surprised to learn that there's an Italian angle to the austerity party.
There is, actually. It's one of the most interesting parts of the research. So I was struck by the fact that when you read all the stuff on expansionary fiscal consolidation done by Alberto Alessina and Sylvia Ardanga at Harvard and others, you notice all the names are Italian, and paper after paper. There's a couple of Swedes, but it was just all these Italians. So I started to research this. And the story goes back to the guy who was the head of the Italian Central Bank and first prime minister of Italy after the war, first president of Italy after World War II, Luigi Einaudi. And Einaudi was this fabulous economist. He used to be the Economist magazine correspondent in Italy under Mussolini and all this sort of stuff. And he basically, given that he grows up in Italy, has no trust of the state whatsoever. And he writes these essays about how it would be great if we had a European Union, because what it would do is it would enable us to have institutions continent-wide that would stop states spending money and running the inflationary pumps. Now, if I grew up in Italy, I mean, it's a pretty rotten state and has been for a long time. They have terrible growth. They do issue too much debt because it's easier to do than raise taxes. There's a huge amount of corruption, all that sort of stuff. All true. But to generalize this to basically all states are bad, and therefore if you cut them, what happens is people's expectations are revised up because they think they'll pay less taxes in the future. And therefore now, despite the economy falling about your ears and you might not have a job next week, you'll go to IKEA and buy a new couch and that'll cure the recession. Borders on the ridiculous. But where it comes from is from Einaudi, because Einaudi sets up the Bocconi School of Economics in Milan, which is a bit like Virginia public choice economics in the United States, like rent-seeking politicians, all that sort of stuff. And it does all this very fancy work in the 70s and 80s. It's also very mathematically teched up. So when you have the big neoclassical revolution in economics in America, the one part of the European academy which can talk to the Americans are the Bocconi boys. So the Bocconi boys begin to move their PhD students over to America, and guess what? They end up running Harvard University in places like this, telling us stories about expansionary fiscal consolidation. So the whole circle drew around this whole link between Einaudi, this particular brand of fiscal conservatism, and then how this feeds into PhD training in economics and ends up back in the United States, which is then read by European politicians and used as the reason to justify budget cuts in the present. So the story's very fascinating and very circular.
Now, we've been emphasizing mostly the intellectual roots of austerity, but surely there are major material interests behind it as well.
Well, there are, but I just don't like making a distinction between the two. I mean, to go back to the earlier example, right, are regulators politically captured? Yes, but to me the more convincing thing is you're captured to the extent that you see your interests as being the same as the person you might be regulating. And if they've, in a sense, written the instruction manual on how the world works, and it seems how it's very convincing, when you go into a big bank and ask them, well, should the leverage ratio be 30-1 or 40-1, you then turn and say, well, according to Basel II, if you run your own risk models, you could do this, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I suppose you're okay. You're thinking in terms of the intellectual framework that somebody else has authored. That's the real source of power. So the intellectual and the material for me go absolutely hand in hand in this. The other way of thinking about it, I don't like to think about just the material interest story, because if you go back to 1977, this is in the back end of Bill Janeway's excellent book, Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy. I highly recommend it. And if you go back to 1977, J.P. Morgan was a limited partnership with 250 people in it. I would add that Hank Paulson wasn't out of college yet. And then you fast forward to 2007, you've got 62,500 people working for J.P. Morgan. So what happened? Were these 250 guys, or at least 10 of them, sitting around planning the ascent of global finance? No. The world is far more complex, conjunctural, and just like random. And people are around and they capitalize upon political initiatives and they argue for certain things, and you end up with huge nonlinear payoffs to the financial sector because of deregulation and so on and so forth. But the notion that sort of, you know, it's really in somebody's interests, yine, as the Germans say, yes and no. I prefer a much more accidental and cock-up theory of history on that one. So to me, the intellectual and the material stories go together, because whenever you have really, really complex systems and complex environments, and finance is the classic example of this, what gives you power is the ability to arbitrage the information in the system. And that's always a question of knowledge, expertise, knowing the language, setting the rules, all of which is deeply intellectual.
And finally, let's talk a bit about politics. How well can austerity live with democracy?
I actually think it's a train wreck which has already hit. I'm extremely pessimistic about this. And what really did this to me was doing the cases in the 1930s and looking at how quickly the Japanese military dispensed with democracy once they'd had enough of budget cuts, cutting down the military to size. They began an assassination campaign against their own governmental and civilian elite, and even started to take out some of the banking elite. So it can happen very quickly. Again, the example, the German misreading of history on this is truly astonishing. You find Merkel talking about the inflation of the 1920s as the reason for not doing Keynesianism. Let's get the story straight. The inflation of 1923 was caused by deliberate government policy, but it was an attempt to screw the French over reparations rather than any attempt at Keynesian stimulus to bother them. That's complete nonsense. Between 1924 and 1928, the German economy was one of the most stable and one of the fastest growing in Europe. It looked like they turned the corner. Then the American short-term money leaves, they start budget cutting, and a minor party that had been written off in 1928 ends up taking 43% of the vote in 1933. So we have the golden dawn down in Greece. You have southern European polities which are chronically bad at dealing with difference and diversity in immigration. They have rotten demographics, Italy, for example, is 218 out of 231 in terms of the age distribution of the world's countries. Your average Italian is 43.6 years old. So you've got real fiscal and growth problems in these countries that they have to deal with irrespective of austerity. You pile austerity on top of that, and it makes the situation worse. The vote for the centre parties begin to crumble and collapse, and they're unable to effectively even argue against austerity. And I find the parallels of the 1920s all too haunting. And these things can change much faster than we think.
And the inevitable question, what's the alternative?
The alternative is something that I like to basically throw back at my libertarian friends. They always insist that economies have self-healing properties and we shouldn't intervene. So I've got an agreement with them. Don't intervene. Austerity is an intervention. It's a huge one. First, do no harm being the first rule of medicine. There's a myopia here in the way that we talk about this, that whenever the government does something, it's an intervention. But whenever you cut the government, it's not an intervention. But it's a myth that government and the markets are not co-determinate. Have a look at the effects of the sequester, and that's a relatively minor cut. So when you whack out 20% of GDP, unless you're willing to tell some fantasy story about how when the government buys a computer and it approves an NIH grant at a public university by a research chemist who invents a molecule that revolutionizes biotech, that's a deadweight loss. And then when the worst author in the world buys a Mac laptop and sits at home and never publishes anything, that somehow adds to GDP. Unless you're willing to make that kind of ridiculous equivalence, then you have to admit that austerity is a determined intervention. So fine, first do no harm. We have not been cutting in the United States, relatively speaking, and we're growing. The Brits have been cutting, and they have their own currency. They're flatlined. Southern Europe has been cutting like you cannot believe. The Greeks have lost 30% of GDP. Nothing is happening except the economy is falling off a cliff. The idea that the Commission turns around and says, yes, but look at the current account, it's getting better. Well, it would do because demand has collapsed to a point that no one can afford imports. So let's say we'll have the fantasy now that every country in Europe runs an export surplus. Who's going to buy it all? Martin Wolf put this beautifully in the Financial Times. He said, who's going to buy all this stuff? Martians? So we have a real natural experiment running now that shows that the first thing you should do is not do it. When you don't do it, the economy might well, even without massive stimulus, start to turn the corner. And then when it starts to turn the corner, the best thing for curing debt is growth. And if you add to that some financial repression to claw back the fact that you basically did the greatest bait and switch in human history to bail out the financial sector and give them asset protection and income protection, then maybe you just might turn the corner without having to turn on the Keynesian pumps all that much.
That was Mark Blyth, author of Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, just out from Oxford University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, an amusing bit of apocalyptic gloom from the Jefferson Airplane. Till next week, bye.